Let's turn to the passage, if you have a New Testament, which is in Matthew 21. As I think I showed on the back of the invitation card to this series, I happened to notice in my study before it that there were many Greek words in the New Testament with the stem of porn. Fornication, many of these words have Greek words behind them which start porn, and one of these words is that which is translated harlot. When I came across this in my study, something subconsciously said to me, didn't Jesus say somewhere in the Gospel something rather startling about prostitutes listening to him when other more respectable and more likely people didn't? And this thought stayed in my mind, and I went over to my concordance and I looked it up, and the passage I found was one that I've never myself studied in detail before. It is this passage in front of us. And in fact, the two sayings of Christ in verse 31 and 32 are, I think, very remarkable. In verse 31, talking to religious leaders, he says, truly I say to you, tax collectors, people they had no use for, and harlots, people they had even less use for, will go into the kingdom of God before you. That must have been a shocking thing to hear. And then verse 32, for John, that is John the Baptist, came to you in the way of righteousness, preaching righteousness, and you did not believe him, you leaders. But the tax collectors and the harlots believed him, and even when you saw this remarkable revival, even then you didn't turn and listen to John the Baptist. Now, it seems to me very striking, this, because there must have been a remarkable revival of interest in the things of God and a remarkable turning to God and to Jesus Christ amongst this very class, if he could say something like that. Verse 32 would make no sense at all unless visibly you could see that many of these people had in fact listened and turned from their wickedness to live. And I must say that when I came to the rather sad and squalid scene, which is our subject during this month, I found this particular verse, these two verses, a great ray of light. It has made me very hopeful, and I hope it will do the same to you. When Jesus says these hopeful things, of course, about harlots and prostitutes, he does not, as some rather trendy people do today in intellectual circles, condone what they are doing and speak of them as though they are people only sinned against and not sinning. Nevertheless, his great influence amongst them must be the result, I think, of the fact that though he spoke the truth very plainly to them, he spoke the truth in love. We had an American student staying here this weekend. He knew that there was a student service in the evening, and he came to it. And on Monday morning, I drove him to the airport to continue his journey, and he said to me, I'm so thankful. And he said, I thought when I came to this church that you'd be buttering them up. Now, at first, I didn't know quite what he meant, but he'd got an idea that in the Church of England, every punch was automatically pulled, and that any truth we spoke had all the hard edges taken off it, and that I wouldn't dream of speaking to the students the real, plain truth of the New Testament. And apparently he'd been relieved that I hadn't, as he called it, buttered it up. We may certainly say that Jesus didn't butter up the truth. When he spoke to these people, I'm quite sure he said plainly that what they did was wrong. Nevertheless, he had a great appeal to them, which is, at first sight, very surprising. Now look with me, if you will, at this little parable of the two sons. I couldn't find anything very much to help me in the commentaries. In fact, in my library, I could find only one reference to this, an old sermon of Spurgeon in the last century entitled Open Neglectors and Nominal Followers. So we'll look at those two. First, the open neglectors in verse 29. This is the first son. His father comes and says, go and work in my vineyard. And he answered, I will not. As I listened to Mr. Leppard reading that from this version, I realized how difficult it was to bring out the original. Actually, what he said was this, certainly not. Now, that must have sounded very surprising to a Jewish audience, because a son had very real responsibilities to his father. But here is a son who makes absolutely no bones about it. It is a refusal point blank. I will not worship God, this man is saying today. I'll certainly not praise my Maker. It doesn't matter how many invitation cards you give me to the Tuesday services. I'm not coming. You don't think you can bring me with you, do you? Certainly not. I'm not going to give up my sin. Why should I? Verse 29, I will not, but afterward he repented. Now that wonderful phrase has been with me for 24 hours and I can't get it out of my mind. Sometimes as you have a tune in your mind that goes on and on and on. And I have come to love that phrase, but afterward. But afterward he changed his mind. And in those two words I see a great deal of hope. I think, for example, of a young fellow in the city who had heard me speak when he was a boy, and a manager in his office who was a Christian asked him to come to St. Helens to a Tuesday service. And this chap had given up all pretense of being a Christian, and he said, I certainly won't come. At least he said, I'll come once to tell this man that I'm not going to listen to this kind of thing anymore. So he came once. And he gave me, as he would put it, a piece of his mind. He showed me the direction that his life was going now, and he says, this is what I enjoy, and this is the life I'm going to lead. And this manager in his office was a most conscientious, anxious fellow. He used to come to me quite regularly, looking terribly depressed. Won't come, won't listen. I will not. Well, it seems almost too good to be true, but 3 years later, this fellow had left the city. He'd made actually an awful mess of his life, and he was going off to Australia to start a completely new life and a new job. And he called on me in the vestry here at St. Helens, and he really was a completely new person. But afterward had happened. He changed his mind. The manager in his office didn't know till I rang him up about it. In fact, I made the young fellow ring him up. He was staying with his sister in London. His sister wasn't a Christian, and his pockets were bulging with books that he was taking to her children that he'd bought off our bookstore. We had our Christmas display on of children's books. He was determined to evangelize his sister, her husband, and all the children, anybody else who was at home. A completely different person. I will not, he had said, but afterward. Now what about the other type? Look at the other type in verse 30. The other type says, and let me try to get the flavor of the original, because there's an emphasis here on the I, yes, as compared with him, I, sir, I will go. There's almost an unctuousness in it. Here Jesus is picturing to us the professing believer who makes great play of what he believes and what he will do. But in fact, nothing ever comes of it. Now, he's easy to recognize, isn't he, in the 20th century. He went out a few weekends ago, sailing. He goes out every weekend. And a few hundred yards offshore, although he's an expert, he capsized. Just for a few minutes, he really thought he was going to go under. And he found himself rather surprisingly praying, oh Lord, if you get me out of this hole, I'll listen to my Christian friends. I'll even start to read the Bible. But within a few minutes, the well-organized rescue operation came into play, and he was picked up and taken ashore, dried out, and only an hour and a half later, he was having a tea in the clubhouse, talking to some of his friends. It seemed years ago since he was in danger, and, well, his Bible is still gathering dust at home. He hadn't thought about it at all. Here's a husband. He's worried as he comes into the city this morning. The doctor has rung him up to say that the delivery of his child is going to be much more difficult than they thought. Unknown to his pagan friends in the foreign exchange market where he works shoulder to shoulder with them on the telephone, he's desperately worried, and between the bids he's praying, oh God, rescue us, deliver my wife safely. I'll pray, we'll pray, we'll become a Christian family. Telephone comes later in the afternoon, all is well. The next day it's all forgotten. Here's a woman. There's a mysterious pain that she feels. She doesn't even tell her husband. She's desperately worried about it. She goes along to the hospital. She waits. She has an examination. For a week or so, it seems that it might be something serious. But after a month or so, everything is cleared up and the diagnosis is optimistic. While she was going through that agonizing month and not telling anyone, quite often she turned to God in prayer, Lord, I'll try and bring my husband and children back to you. I'll try and bring back Christianity into our family. I'll try and train the children. I know I've forgotten. I'll try and do something about it. I'll go back to the minister up the road to that church and I'll enroll them for Bible class. But she did nothing about it. They have a car now and it's so easy to get away on a Sunday. And, well, the pain isn't there and the conviction isn't there any longer. I go, sir. But she didn't. Now, I have no personal access to heavenly statistics at all. But I think I dare to say, without over-assurance, that in the heavenly statistics there are literally thousands of people in the city today who have been in that position. I want to go back, however, for the remainder of our time to the tax collectors and the harlots. They come under the heading of verse 29, I will not bear afterward. And I want to ask the question that is a much more hopeful one. Why is there so often an afterward with these people? Why is it sometimes that they do listen in the end? What is it that made many prostitutes listen to Christ, listen to John the Baptist, and turn back to God? And I want to give you three things that have occurred to me as I've meditated on this story. Three words. And the first is emptiness. You remember the story of the prodigal, how when he got into the far country to live life as he wanted to live it, he found himself in a pigsty eating pig's food. A very vivid picture of the awful hunger that there will come to us when we get far away from God. We'll eat almost anything to fill ourselves up, but of course there's no satisfaction in it. Now that story is becoming, in my judgment, for a preacher at any rate and a Christian teacher, a story that we've got to turn back to again and again. In front of our eyes, it's becoming true today amongst young people. I'm meeting young people in the hospitals and places where I work every day almost, certainly every week, who have been trying to eat pig's food and are desperately hungry. Now, that may sound rather exaggerated. I used to think that preachers were rather naughty in this. They used to get in the pulpit and work out the sense of need. You remember that Horlicks advertisement about night starvation? You know, they tried to work us up to think that while we were sleeping perfectly happily with sweet dreams, we were all suffering from starvation. Quite a clever gimmick, really. We all felt perfectly all right. But they said, no, actually, you're starving. I used to think some preachers were like that. They get up in the pulpit and they say, you're all starving. You're all very, very hungry for spiritual things. And plenty of young men in the city sitting listening to Dick Lucas on a Tuesday say, I'm not. I'm not starving. Well, I wonder if it is so today. I think it's much more likely to be so. Now, it obviously is amongst many people such as those I've mentioned. Let me mention another type. There's a very powerful Christian voice that has recently been raised in the part of London where this church is, and that is a new consultant physician in the London hospital, Dr. Duncan Vere. A very remarkable Christian man. He's been speaking and lecturing and writing quite a lot recently with great effect amongst the medical fraternity. He's been doing research into drug dependence as part of his work. And here is something he said in a recent lecture about it. I suggest that the underlying cause for drug dependence, as all other dependence, is emotional deprivation, even in the midst of material plenty. Have you ever thought that there is one thing which, when you look for it, can never be found? It is nothing. Nothing is the one thing which can never be detected. You can never prove statistically that something is absent, only that it is present. You see, he's talking in terms of the consultant physician who is examining these people to see what is wrong. And the thing that is wrong is the one thing that doesn't come up on his microscope, on his chart. If there is an emotional vacuum in someone's heart, all the research of centuries cannot make it known. Our society depends on materialism. You work hard at school and you will have means to gain cars, washing machines, holiday fun, even sex and yes, drugs. But in your innermost heart, there may still be nothing. Our young people, he writes, even when they steal something or are violent or just sit naked on the beach on the Isle of Wight, are saying to us they want better pleasures than we can give them, etc. Nothing. Emptiness. Now that's why the Christian gospel is meaning so much more to many people who've completely neglected it hitherto. Because the Bible has a great deal to say about nothing. Let us say it has a great deal to say about the emptiness in the human heart that can be satisfied by God alone. Listen to just a few verses from the Psalms. Psalm 36, 7. How precious is thy steadfast love, O God! The children of men take refuge in the shadow of thy wings. They feast on the abundance of thy house, and thou givest them drink from the river of thy delights, for with thee is the fountain of life. Tremendous language, isn't it, of the power of God to satisfy human desires. Psalm 63. O God, says David, thou art my God, I seek thee, my soul thirsts for thee, my flesh faints for thee, as in a dry and weary land where no water is. That's exactly our country in many ways today, isn't it? Spiritually, socially. So I have looked upon thee in the sanctuary, beholding thy power and glory. Because thy steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise thee. My soul is feasted as with marrow and fat, and my mouth praises thee with joyful lips. There are a number of people in St. Helens who can say those words with new meaning in the last few months. So I have looked upon thee. Psalm 107, listen to this, verse 4. Some wandered in desert wastes, finding no way to a city to dwell in. Hungry and thirsty, their soul fainted within them. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for he satisfies him who is thirsty, and the hungry he fills with good things. I wasn't going to read the next few verses, but I think I'll go on reading, because this describes those who are in bondage to evil, in particular to uncleanness. And there may be some young people today in church who are in bondage to these things. Listen to this then. Some sat in darkness and in gloom, prisoners in affliction and in iron. They had rebelled against the words of God and spurned the counsel of the Most High. Their hearts were bowed down with hard labor. They fell down with none to help. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He brought them out of darkness and gloom and broke their bonds asunder. Notice, he brought them out of gloom. They thought it was going to be happiness. And he broke their bonds asunder. Isn't that good news? That's what God can do for you. He can do that to the prisoner, as Christ did it to the harlots of his own day, and to the tax gatherers, and to many others. Emptiness, that is the first thing that makes men turn back to God. Men who you'd never expect, women whom you'd never expect. Second, shame. Now, I went through the Gospels and looked at all the stories of prostitutes who came to Jesus, and there's a lovely story in Luke 7 we haven't time to turn to now. It's told in very great detail about a woman of the city who came into a supper party. She wasn't invited and she wasn't welcome because of what she was. But she was welcomed by Christ, and we're told how she knelt at his feet and wept over his feet, and so great were the tears that they watered his feet and she dried them with her hair. And Christ said, you know, this woman had very great sins, and she's been forgiven, and that's why she has very great love. This is one of the great things you find in the Bible, is that those who come from very far distant often make the very best followers of Christ. It's often those who've been against Christ who, when they become for Christ, put us all to shame. Now, the tears that that woman shed are usually the mark of shame. I thank God for a sense of guilt and shame. When that sense disappears, we're in a bad place. There's a word in the New Testament that is translated in the Authorization lasciviousness. It's not a very helpful translation. The word asalgaia means shamelessness. It refers to the man who no longer sins in the darkness and in secret and behind closed doors, but has come right out into the open and says, I don't care who sees what I do, I don't mind, and I don't mind who sees. He is utterly shameless. This asalgaia, the shamelessness, is one of the last marks of a society that has left God out of its thinking. And it's a desperate mark, because it means there is nothing that God in his love, in a way, can latch onto. But, of course, in many people, like that woman in Luke 7, there was still this sense of shame, and those tears were a mark of it. David Wilkerson, working in New York, says that amongst many of the young people there who are right out on the fringes of society, the first mark of them coming back to God are tears. That is the indication of a real shame. Now, that shame is not often felt in EC3, as we're all says respectable, I suppose. And it takes the Holy Spirit of God, if I may say this reverently, a great deal to wake us up to the shame we ought to feel. But people like the tax gatherers and the harlots, I suppose it was easier in a sense for them to see the shame that was written over their lives. That's another thing that brought them to God and made them listen to Christ. And then in the last minute, the third thing. Emptiness, shame, and I think very much a sense of wonder. In Luke 15:1, we're told that the tax collectors, people like that, harlots, were drawing near to listen to Christ. Why? Well, in Luke 15, the writer goes on to say to us that when they came to Christ, they heard him telling stories about a shepherd that went after a lost sheep because he valued the one that was lost. Now, I think that what these people found when they listened to Christ was something that's quite intangible, that can't be said, but is very, very remarkable when you see it, and that is a sense that this man who is talking religion to me really values me. He's not trying to make me 325 on the synagogue roll. He's not at the moment going to slip out an envelope and say, this is our weekly envelope system in the synagogue, and I've got hold of you, would you join up? No, he values me for what I am. I remember when I first came to St. Helens, we had a child, we still have it actually, it lives in a vault. I think it's a Charles II flagon. It's too valuable ever to use. You couldn't put it on the holy table there for 10 minutes in the afternoon without somebody trying to come in and steal it. When I came to St. Helens, it lived in the clergy vestry cupboard. It was black, rather like the old guns that were there. And I remember kicking it. I didn't know what it was. I had never been introduced to Charles II flagons before. But fortunately, someone came into the vestry who knew the value of it, looked it up and was horrified to see that this thing was sculling about at the bottom of the cupboard and being kicked. It now resides in great glory in a very important vault with a very important label on it. Because it is a very important flagon. These people were normally kicked about, the tax collectors and harlots, and they normally are today. But they met at last someone who would not be put off with from them. Let me just tell you one story for this. The story is true of some boys in a school not so far away from here that persistently ill-treated the new woman Christian teacher they had. And one of the boys said, "We want her to hate us." And all that they met in this woman was firmness, but persistent affection and goodwill towards them. And I needn't tell you that after a few weeks, she'd completely conquered them. And the same boy said, "We were so thankful to find someone who wouldn't give us up." Now you see what they met, something that they were looking for, they didn't think they would find, they were looking for what the Bible calls grace. Someone you could not dent, but would continue to treat you as a value.